Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. David Katz. Dr. Katz is one of the world's great champions for bringing a focus on nutrition and prevention into established medical institutions. He's a nutritionist, best-selling author, and a globally recognized authority on lifestyle medicine. Dr. Katz is founding director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center and the immediate past president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. He's published 200 scientific articles and 15 books with a focus on preventive medicine and nutrition. And he serves as founder of True Health Initiative, for which my dad and I also serve as members. This is a coalition of more than 250 world-renowned physicians, scientists, and nutrition experts who are committed to establishing and communicating a growing scientific consensus on the optimal diet for human beings. So now, David, we are so glad to have this time with you. And for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean. And thank you, David, for being with us once again.
It's a pleasure, John. Ocean, thanks for such a kind introduction.
You know, many people today don't think there's all that much correlation between what they eat and the health they will experience in their lives. So they simply eat what's convenient and what tastes good. David, what I want to ask you is, what does the science say? And have we as a society greatly underestimated the power that junk food has to cause illness and that healthy food has to create health and healing?
Yeah, so no question, John, we've underestimated it. And the science says the exact opposite of where our culture seems to be going. And it's really quite objective. In epidemiology, we talk about something called attributable risk, which is, you know, if there's a certain mortality rate every year in our country, what are the specific explanations for different percentages of that toll? And all the way back to 1993, 24 years ago, there was a famous paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled Actual Causes of Death in the United States. And what the authors were looking at was, what are the underlying root causes of the things that show up on death certificates? So death certificates will say heart disease, cancer, stroke, etc. But what causes that? And in 1993, the answer was 10 factors, which we knew how to modify even then. And the first three were tobacco, poor diet, lack of physical activity. So if we go back, John, 24 years, diet was number two. And in particular, when it was combined with lack of physical activity, they very nearly rivaled tobacco as the leading cause of premature death in our country. But if we fast forward now to 2017, diet's number one for bad reasons and good. The good reasons are there's a lot less smoking in our culture now. But the bad reasons are we have neglected the power of diet over health, just as you say. I think to some extent all the pseudo-confusion about diet has propagated distrust for experts and maybe disgust with everything we have to say. So, you know, the public just says, to heck with it. I'll eat whatever I want. But that's calamitous. It's calamitous to human health. It's potentially calamitous to the planet and biodiversity and the climate and everything that matters. The truth is that the most recent research on the topic says emphatically and incontrovertibly that poor diet is the number one cause, the underlying cause of premature death in the United States today.
You referred to pseudo-confusion. When it comes to health news, the media tends to fixate on the latest controversy or the newest diet craze. So we get a lot of provocative headlines and we get a lot of splashy sound bites. But what we don't often get is solid and credible health information. David, does this bias that the media has toward whatever will generate the most attention and get the most clicks have something to do with why so many people feel confused and baffled today about what they should eat?
Well, no question, John. In fact, so much so that I've sort of devoted this whole phase of my career to combating that problem of pseudo-confusion. So the True Health Initiative is one response to that. And I'm enormously grateful to you and Ocean for serving on that council of directors, which, by the way, is more than 350 strong. And the experts on that council are from 33 countries. So, you know, all standing up to defend the fundamental truths that routinely do get obscured. And I'm currently working on a book called The Truth About Food, because, you know, I think the truth about food is simple. And frankly, what's complicated is the web of deceptions that makes it impossible to see. Certainly the media is involved and hyperbolic headlines, but the problem runs deep. I mean, this whole age of fake news and alternative truth, which, you know, sort of overtaken our culture altogether, well, nutrition's been there a while. So, you know, you can kind of say anything about nutrition. Anybody gets to be an expert. I mean, if you had breakfast yesterday, you get to be an expert about nutrition. If you lost weight once, you get to be an expert. And now with the blogosphere, you know, there's no filter. It used to be if you wanted to publicize an opinion, you had to convince at least somebody, some editor, that you were worth listening to. But now, you know, all you need is internet access and an echo chamber of people who feel the way you do. And the next thing you know, there's a whole new fad. So, you know, I think that's compounded the problem. And then there's the nature of science, John. And I think the public probably mostly doesn't know that this is part of the problem, too. If you're genuinely expert in any given area, you don't really want to devote your time to talking about the stuff that everybody agrees on. You know, that's not interesting. That's not at the frontier. You know, you can think about experts as being the frontiers people. You know, they're sort of pushing back the boundary of what we know. Well, what that means is they're always flirting with uncertainty. You know, they're in that realm where the territory is least well known and they're blazing new trails. So in the beginning, in that space, there's going to be lots of disagreement. I went over here and I saw this. You went over there and you saw that. We saw different things. We disagree. It's going to take time to sort it out. The problem is that can seem like it's all there is, when the reality is we agree about most things. Most scientists around the world who really understand nutrition agree about most of the fundamentals. It's just not what we talk about, and it's not what the media covers. And to try and push back against that problem, the True Health Initiative is all about the fundamentals, that area of common ground.
It seems to me that one of the fundamentals that's really important for people to understand is that we now know with a great deal of certainty that a short list of lifestyle factors, not smoking, maintaining a healthy weight, being active, and eating well, could cut overall rates of chronic disease and premature death by 80%. You know, David, I think an 80% reduction in the incidence of all chronic disease would count among the most spectacular advances in the history of public health.
John, I could have said it better myself. Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. And I rant about that all the time. And so, you know, first of all, it's absolutely true. And it's not even really controversial. I mean, it's hard to find a cardiologist or an endocrinologist or a pediatrician or an intensivist or a nutrition expert or a public health expert who will disagree with that statistic. It's so consistent in the literature. Study after study after study shows that if you get this very short list of lifestyle practices right, your risk of ever developing any major chronic disease, so, you know, we're really talking about all the bad stuff here, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, dementia, goes down about 80%. It's incredible. And we have the same information from all different kinds of research methods and from observing entire populations. So, for example, Dan Buettner's work with the Blue Zones, an examination on behalf of National Geographic of those populations that most routinely live to be 100 years old. What do they get right? They get the lifestyle medicine formula right. It's the formula that emerges again and again in intervention studies that have shown incredible things, like, you know, no development of chronic disease over a span of years when you get that formula right, changing gene expression in a way that prevents cancer from progressing, even altering the very structure of our chromosomes. There's a great book recently out called The Telomere Effect. One of the authors, Elizabeth Blackburn, is a Nobel laureate in medicine. And that book is filled with evidence about how lifestyle can change the length of our telomeres, the caps at the ends of our chromosomes, which are one of the best predictors in all of biology of the length of healthy lives.
You know, there are many food myths in the culture today that confuse people, but they're widely believed to be true, even though they aren't. David, are there food myths that are prevalent today that you would like to see exposed as the fictions they are?
Lots and lots of them, and I work on that all the time, John, and they change. You know, one of the challenges here is that you can spend your whole life chasing after the new myth, or, and this is even more frustrating, the myths get recirculated because our attention spans are pretty short, the news cycles are pretty tight, and so, you know, what was a fad 20 minutes ago is old news, which means it's time to refresh it and try it again, and that happens too. And I'd like to make real progress rather than chasing down myths. I'll give you an example of my frustration. I think it was about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, I did an interview for the New York Times on whether or not it was still okay to eat fruit. I thought that was absurd. We've known forever that fruits and vegetables, the wholesome, unprocessed fruits and vegetables, are the best foods there are. What really matters about diet for health, John, is the overall dietary pattern. And one of the things that these myths tend to share is they drill down to isolate a silver bullet or a scapegoat. And I, you know, if I had to offer one bit of advice to protect you, not only against the myths we've seen before, but the next one that will come around the bend, because it certainly will, if what you hear implies that, you know, everything about diet comes down to a silver bullet or a scapegoat, step away from your credit card and nobody will get hurt. It's wrong.
Well, there are people today saying very, very vocally that meat and butter and cheese have a central role to play in an optimally healthy diet. David, how much credibility does that view have to you?
None. Absolutely none. Now, to be clear, John, I don't think we can say that the best diet for human health has to exclude meat entirely. First of all, it depends on the kind of meat. There was a fascinating recent study published in The Lancet about a tribe in the Amazon that effectively lives in the modern world as Stone Age foragers. They do a little bit of agriculture, but they mostly eat wild plants, but they do hunt. But the animals that they eat are wild animals. They're very lean. They have virtually no saturated fat in them. You know, they in turn eat a native diet of wild plants. Now, I'm not saying that's a good idea, but I am saying, you know, that it appears to be perfectly consistent with good human health. I think the strongest argument against eating meat, either much or any, is environmental. There are nearly 8 billion Homo sapiens on the planet now, and substantially carnivorous diets for that voracious horde is quite simply catastrophic for the planet, for everything that matters, our water supply, our air, our land, our biodiversity, which is this planet's greatest treasure. So, you know, I think you could accommodate meat and potentially some unprocessed pure dairy in a healthy diet for a small number of humans. But for this to be a mainstay in the diets of large numbers of humans is environmentally catastrophic. And there are major ethical problems with it too, because when you're mass producing meat or dairy, the methods that are used tend to be quite cruel. And frankly, I think if we humans are genuinely humane, there's simply no place for cruelty on the menu. But when it comes down to specific issues of human health, there's no question that the best diets, the diets that are most consistently associated with longevity and vitality, are overwhelmingly plant predominant. I don't think we can say with confidence, John, whether, you know, the best diet for human health outcomes includes or excludes fish, for example. Again, if we're just thinking about human health outcomes, and forgetting about the planet and the environment and the oceans for a minute, it would be hard to say, because most of the evidence that we do have suggests that fish inclusion in the diet is beneficial. But have we compared in a long-term randomized trial an optimal, strictly plant diet, a vegan diet, to a pescatarian diet? And the answer is no, it hasn't been done yet. So in general, your diet should emphasize vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, and plain water when you're thirsty, overwhelmingly. If you get that formula right, whatever else you do, you can't go too far wrong. Are there advantages or disadvantages to the inclusion of small amounts of lean meat or fish or dairy in the diet? In terms exclusively of human health outcomes, it's a bit hard to say, and we'd have to go deep into the weeds, I think, to parse that. But in terms of environmental impact, so planetary health along with the health of people, and let's face it, there are no healthy people who don't have a habitable planet to call their own, I think it's critical that we de-emphasize meat and dairy in our diets for the health of people and planet alike.
Listening to you, I'm reminded of something Michael Pollan famously said, advising us to eat food, not too much, mostly plants. A recent Oxford University study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says that following his advice, particularly the mostly plants part, would not only make us healthier and extend our lifespans, but would also have a huge impact on the planet and the global economy. The researchers who conducted the study concluded that if everyone ate less meat and other animal products and ate more fruits and vegetables and whole grains, it would reduce global mortality by up to 10% and reduce food-related greenhouse gas emissions by as much as 70%. And making these changes, the study said, would also save up to $31 trillion by 2050, thanks to fewer damaging environmental impacts and reduced healthcare costs.
Numbers.
That's a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
$31 trillion is a staggering
incredible
amount of money.
Yep. John, I know the paper, Springman et al.
Yes.
And I know several of the authors there at Oxford. And in fact, Mike Rayner, who's the senior author in that paper, is a colleague of ours on the True Health Initiative Council. I thought that paper was stunning. And, you know, stunning because it looked from altitude. And it did something that we're not very good at doing. We're certainly not good at doing it politically. And that is, you know, looking over a time horizon that really matters. I mean, we tend to make short-term decisions and seek short-term gratification, but they looked over a span of decades. And they acknowledged, you know, to change anything requires an initial push. So if we're going to change the way large populations of people eat, there'll be some initial investment. But I'm with you. I mean, they showed a massive, massive savings of both lives and money over time. So, you know, everybody, no matter where you are in the political spectrum, you should get in line for this. If mostly you're a humanist and you care about the people, well, this is for you. But if mostly you care about money and the economy, yeah, this is for you too. I totally agree. And then back to where you began, Michael Pollan's seven pithy words, I quote them all the time. I think they're exactly right. We mean your diet should mostly be made up of minimally processed vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds. And then whatever else you include, if you include anything else, you know, should be in much smaller quantities. Your diet should mostly be made up of those things. And again, plain water when you're thirsty. And if you get that right, you can't go too far wrong. And that's one of the big mistakes I think we've made, John, and we've been making it for decades, is, and you know, when Michael Pollan first wrote those words, he was talking about the perils of focusing on nutrients and losing sight of the foods. So, you know, fixation on anything, whether it's sugar or fructose or saturated fat, or, you know, again, it invites that liability of missing the forest for the trees. And you know, his description was very apt, but he was also saying, you know, how about we get the foods right, and then maybe the nutrients will take care of themselves. We've been trying to get one nutrient at a time right for decades, and we've made a mess of the foods, and I completely agree with him.
You mentioned saturated fat. I want to talk for a moment about the controversy of late about saturated fat. I've looked at the studies. My perception of what they're saying is that there's little or no benefit if you cut saturated fat and replace it with sugar and other refined carbohydrates. But if you cut saturated fat and replace it with healthier foods, including healthier fats, then there is a significant drop in heart disease risk. David, what's your view of the saturated fat controversy?
My view is that all I need to append to that, John, is amen. Exactly right. And so, you know, the people who are carrying on about saturated fat is good for us now, I mean, they just haven't done their homework. I don't know whether, you know, in most cases they haven't read the original studies or if they're willfully misrepresenting them because, you know, they're on the payroll of the beef industry. I'm not sure. I suspect there's a variety of motivations. But that interpretation is exactly correct. Most people making noise about saturated fat is good for us now never bothered to say compared to what. And the studies they cite ignored that issue as well. And really what they found, and there are two studies in particular that everybody is quoting whether they realize it or not, both meta-analyses, one from 2010 by Siri Torino et al., and one in 2014 by Chowdhury et al. And both of these meta-analyses of studies about saturated fat found that across a fairly narrow range of variable saturated fat intake in the real world, rates of heart disease were constant. Now, you know, where in that you get the message that therefore saturated fat is good for us, I have absolutely no idea. I really don't. But what it actually means is what you just said. There's more than one way to eat badly, and Americans seem committed to exploring them all. So, yeah, I mean, if you eat a little bit less pepperoni pizza and replace it with Snackwell cookies, no, your situation doesn't improve. And that much less so if you actually don't stop eating the pepperoni pizza and simply add the Snackwell cookies. And the actual fact, John, is that the best trend data we have in the U.S. show that we never really reduced our intake of fat, and only barely reduced our intake of saturated fat. What we did was dilute down the percent of calories from fat and saturated fat by eating more highly processed carbohydrate and added sugar. Well, you know, I mean, if anybody thought, if I eat a pepperoni pizza, as long as I chase it down, you know, with low-fat junk food, all will be well. You know, I've got bridges to sell those folks. So, you know, I mean, really, it's completely absurd. So you're absolutely right. No evidence that saturated fat is good for us. And again, it's not about saturated fat. It's about the food sources. We're getting most of our saturated fat from, you know, animal foods. And these animals have been fed poorly and raised in unnatural ways. Very often it's from highly processed meats. It's from highly processed dairy products. I mean, these foods have many liabilities. Saturated fat is just one of them. So, you know, I think it's really more a problem of those foods. But as you say, the studies show consistently and emphatically, if you replace saturated fat calories with unsaturated fat calories from nuts and seeds and olive and avocado, rates of heart disease and premature death from all causes go down dramatically. If you replace saturated fat calories with calories from whole grains, rates of heart disease and premature death go down dramatically.
What do you think would happen if someone replaced saturated fat calories that came from factory farm dairy products or factory farm meat products with saturated fat from organic coconut oil?
Well, it's an interesting question. Coconuts do help make the case that not all saturated fat is created equal. So the predominant saturated fatty acid in coconut oil is lauric acid. And it's a medium chain fat which does not seem to be pro-inflammatory and it does not seem to be atherogenic. And so, you know, we do need to concede that not all saturated fat is created equal. Another saturated fat that's probably harmless is stearic acid, and that predominates in dark chocolate. So, you know, if Americans were eating really well overall and then eating dark chocolate-covered coconut, I wouldn't have major concerns about that. I think that's fine.
You know, part of what encumbers our healthcare system today is that it's not really about caring for health. It's about treating disease. And it's overwhelmed. It's totally overwhelmed with treating diseases, most of which are unnecessary and could have been prevented with healthier diets and lifestyles. You and I both know that. Many of our listeners know that. It's an experience anybody has who has to deal with a hospital. You had an experience of this reality very recently. Do you want to tell us what that was about and what you learned and saw?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I appreciate you raising the issue and raising it so well, John. So as you know, my mother was recently in the hospital. And just to start this story where it ought to begin, as you say, 80% of chronic disease is preventable with lifestyle means. And most of the burden of disease in the United States and the modern world at large is chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, dementia, and so on. These are the things that overwhelm hospitals. So, you know, our system is massively expensive. There are an awful lot of people working in the so-called healthcare system. but not enough. We in some places we have shortages of doctors. We routinely have shortages of nurses. And the folks in hospitals these days are really very, very sick, you know, because of the financial disincentives for long hospital stays. You only get to be in the hospital when you're quite sick. So, you know, these very good people, hardworking, caring people, are in a system that is continuously overwhelmed. My mother had an elective orthopedic procedure, and my mother, by the way, is 77 years old, but extremely healthy. She hikes and bikes and skis, and that's why she had a knee replacement, because she's kind of worn out her knee doing that stuff and wants to keep going. There were a couple of complications following her procedure, but none of which would have set her back for very long, but she wound up in the hospital because of them. And, you know, basically, just to capture the fundamentals here, we found her, and I have, there are two physicians in my family, myself and my father, who's a cardiologist. And so I'll spare you the details of who was there when, but essentially we found her on one occasion with an IV just running in a corner room where she was far from nurses and nobody paying any attention in pulmonary edema. Her lungs were filled with fluid. Now, you know, she's not prone to that. There's no reason that should have happened. They just had IVs running into her and kind of forgot about her.
Oh, my.
But it could have killed her. And then that got so bad, she was transferred to the intensive care unit where they went on to fix the problem by diuresing the extra fluid off. And that, in turn, resulted in us finding her with a blood pressure of 40. Now, nobody was reacting to that. Now, blood pressure of 40, there's only one thing beyond the blood pressure as low as 40, and that's a full-blown cardiac arrest. Now, it's not that alarms weren't going off, but the overwhelmed staff in a busy ICU has alarm fatigue. There are alarms going off everywhere all the time. So nobody was really paying attention. And at that time, it was my sister who was stationed at the bedside who called me at whatever time of night that was. And I said, okay, run out in the hall and yell until the whole team comes into her room. And they did and avoided the cardiac arrest. Which is what would have happened, and then they would have rushed in and done a resuscitation, which would have succeeded or failed. Anyway, I've written about this, John, partly to vent, but partly because I want to turn it into something constructive. And what's been stunning and disheartening at the same time, I was sort of expecting, you know, when I said the system, you know, it, frankly, is killing our loved ones inadvertently, I expected some of my colleagues to take offense. Instead, I've gotten dozens and dozens and dozens of it happened to me too. And they're coming, you know, not just from the average citizen, although, you know, in many cases it is the average citizen, but it's coming from fellow doctors. It's coming from nurses. In one instance, a critical care nurse whose family member was hospitalized, and she said it was all she could do to prevent the system from killing her loved one. Now, this is not, you know, nefarious intentions. These are good people doing their best in a system that's overwhelmed. There are a number of potential solutions here. And by the way, I do encourage everybody, if you've got a loved one who's really sick in the hospital, figure out a way, you know, rally the troops and make sure you've got family there all the time. Keep a watch and advocate. It makes a huge difference.
You had two physicians, you and your dad, on the team. When folks don't have anyone with sophisticated medical knowledge or any credibility to the staff, it's worse.
It's a nightmare.
It's worse.
It's absolutely worse. And it was bad even for us. I mean, it was very clear that we crossed a line where our colleagues were rolling their eyes at us. We were stepping on toes. We were intruding. We were overstepping our bounds. We got reprimanded by one of the intensivists kindly, but still, you know, it was, hey, you know, you guys, you don't have privileges in this hospital. And, you know, okay, but your hospital's trying to kill my mother, so
yeah.
I don't really give a damn. You know, but you're absolutely right. We had to struggle to be heard despite who we are in the system. I can only imagine how bad it is for people who are just ignored all along. It's a huge problem. But the definitive solution to this, John, is what we're talking about. It's using lifestyle as medicine more routinely, so our system is not overwhelmed with people who are unnecessarily sick. I don't know if there's any way to have enough nurses when you live in a culture that propagates obesity and chronic disease for profit. And that's literally what we do. I mean, you think about the commercials that are on TV in our culture every day. Our culture actively peddles multicolored marshmallows as part of a complete breakfast for children. And then we're left to wring our hands about epidemic rates of type 2 diabetes in our kids. So, you know, we're causing the system to be overwhelmed. And although we talk about a healthcare system, we do not have a system that is even remotely about caring for health. We have a system that's all about caring for established disease, most of which doesn't need to occur.
It doesn't, and it's overwhelming us in costs and in the standards of care that get deteriorated so badly. But less than a quarter of the medical schools in the United States today have even a single required course in nutrition. And of the 130 accredited medical schools in the country, only 4 have a nutrition department. And even while we've been learning more and more about the diet-health connection in the past decades, and even while there is so much that we know, the amount of nutritional education taught in medical schools has actually been decreasing. Now, we want to change this. We want to see the healing power of whole foods nutrition taught in medical schools. We want to eliminate a lot of these diseases and reduce the pressure on the medical system. And at the Food Revolution Network, we're partnering with you, David, in a campaign to get the proven role of whole foods nutrition in preventing and reversing disease into the exams that medical school students must take to become licensed physicians. David, you're joining with us in this. Why do you think this is so important?
Well, first of all, it is so important, John, and I want to thank you and Ocean because you really are leaders in this space, and you bring something to this battle that the rest of us don't have. I mean, you've got this large following. I mean, when you speak, an awful lot of people listen, and I think that's really important. And I think you're directing new eyes to this problem as well. It's a huge problem, and there are many reasons for it, John. And you know, we've had conversations at times with you and with Ocean about this. Believe it or not, the architecture of the modern medical education was established in 1920 and has not been fundamentally altered since. 1920, it's 100 years old. It was something called the Flexner Report. And, you know, back in the days of the Flexner Report, the nutritional problems of public health were nutrient deficiencies. As long as you knew some biochemistry, as long as you knew what B vitamins did for people, you were a nutrition expert. They weren't dealing with chronic diseases related to bad dietary patterns and hyper-processed food and fast food. So there really was no need for doctors to be expert in behavior change or dietary counseling. All of that has changed. So, you know, frankly, I think we need a new Flexner report, something out of the National Academy of Medicine that fundamentally reorients medical education. But while waiting for something that radical, we need to do exactly what we're doing. We need efforts to innovate and introduce nutrition education into medical schools. There are people doing great work in that area. I love David Eisenberg at Harvard, who's one of the leaders in culinary medicine, the idea that, well, maybe we should teach medical students how to cook healthy food because then they'll benefit themselves and also be able to pay it forward. You know, then talking to their patients about eating well is not abstract. It has nothing to do with biochemistry. It has everything to do with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, that's where the rubber hits the road. I love that model. There's a great example of it at Tulane as well. But right now we're relying on those individual champions. And what you and Ocean and the Food Revolution are helping to make happen now is systems change. And that will reach a lot more people. And so I totally agree. We need to change the standard testing that medical students go through because that in turn results in changes in medical curriculum. And we also need to change the practice of medicine. And that in turn means changing reimbursement models. And there's some progress in that area. So, you know, I think our work is cut out for us to try and find this room in medical education, but also to try and reform the practice of physicians. And it reverts back to the problem we were discussing before, John, and that is, you know, we talk about a healthcare system. It's really a euphemism for a system that's all about money and treating disease. And business as usual is, you know, use a drug to treat things that never needed to happen if people ate well and lived well in the first place. And the health professionals who are prescribing the drugs are uninvolved in advising people on how to eat well and live well to reduce the burden of disease. All of that needs to be fixed. I'm very proud to be partnering with you and Ocean, the Food Revolution, to try and address that. It's been a lifelong battle.
And it continues. And all of our members will be part of it as we grow. You know, when you talk about prevention and lessening the burden of disease, I think how important it is that everyone have a healthy diet, and regardless of their economic status. And I want to talk with you for a moment about the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, often referred to as the SNAP program, used to be called the Food Stamp Program. This is a program whose goal is to provide access to food for economically disadvantaged people, Americans. We still have a lot of work to do to combat food insecurity, and I would love to see us take a much bigger bite out of hunger in this country. I think access to healthy food should be a right, not a privilege, and it shouldn't depend on having the money to afford it. And I think we all need to recognize that the effort to reduce hunger in America, that in that effort, the SNAP program is playing a critical role. But that doesn't mean the program couldn't be improved. And right now, while the SNAP program certainly helps economically disadvantaged people to afford food, we're mostly helping them to afford poor food, which all too often leads to poor health. We're providing calories, but an awful lot of those are empty calories. And this has only worsened the alarming health disparities that exist between the economic classes in the country today. Now, David, I know this is a topic you've given a lot of thought. Is there anything you would propose?
The first reaction to this soliloquy is, again, amen, John. I think you're saying a lot of really important things, and I appreciate listening to you and hearing you express them so well. That's exactly right. So I support SNAP just as you do. I think confronting the issue of food insecurity and hunger is a critical public health objective. And SNAP is an attempt to do it, but it's not doing it all that well. And, you know, frankly, as taxpayers, we need to acknowledge that we're sending something like $80 billion a year to the federal government to underwrite SNAP, to help poor people choose poor food, to get to poor health, so we can all spend a lot more tax money through Medicaid to pay the cost of covering the treatment of that disease, which never needed to develop in the first place. Everybody in that scenario loses. And I've been involved in several research papers that have compared the diets of SNAP participants to matched non-participants who are equally poor and equally food insecure. And believe it or not, John, the diets and health of the SNAP participants were worse because they were able to buy more junk food, essentially. So that's a huge problem. So the system has good intentions, but it's not getting the job done. And I have thought a lot about how we could fix that. And one of the things I've been involved in over my career was the development of a nutrient profiling system. It's called NuVal. But for our purposes, what's important is it assesses the overall nutritional quality of foods objectively and puts them on a scale from 1 to 100. The higher the number, the more nutritious the food. And that's important because, of course, you know, the whole fruits and vegetables are good for us, but there are better and worse choices in every aisle of the supermarket. There's better breakfast cereal and better bread and better pasta sauce and better salad dressing. And the reality is people are going to shop for those kinds of things, SNAP and non-SNAP alike. I mean, you know, all of us buy some stuff that comes in bags, boxes, bottles, jars, and cans. And there are good and bad choices to make there. Most people can't tell the difference. Well, we've scored with the NuVal system over 125,000 foods, and I have long proposed, and I've tried to advance this agenda. I've said, you know, how about we convert this into pocket cards for SNAP beneficiaries, and we attach financial incentives so that a dollar's worth of SNAP vouchers is only worth a dollar if you're buying foods in the bottom quartile of scores. But if you move up to the next quartile, a dollar's worth $1.25, and in the next quartile, $1.50, and in the top quartile, $2. And now all of a sudden, we are providing a financial inducement for SNAP beneficiaries to choose better food to get to better health. The system will probably pay for itself 10 times over, and I've spoken to a number of health economists who agree, by, you know, just bending the curve related to chronic disease. You don't have to prevent an awful lot of bariatric surgery or coronary bypass to readily cover the cost of incentivizing healthy food.
You know, Stanford University researchers estimated that if sugar-sweetened beverages were excluded from SNAP purchases, the overall consumption of sodas and similar drinks would be reduced by at least 15%. And that prospect infuriated the soda companies. And they began marshaling their nearly unlimited resources to prevent such a thing from happening. I don't know how we could estimate what a reduction of that magnitude would have on obesity and diabetes rates, but it would be considerable. And I don't know if we could exactly estimate what the savings would be in dollars, but it would be likewise enormous.
I completely agree. And of course, you know, what you're doing at the Food Revolution, John, is part of the solution because you're raising awareness, rallying people to common cause. I've long thought, you know, as we all suffer the ills imposed upon us by a system that kowtows to special interests like the beverage industry, what if we found a way to turn loving parents and grandparents into a special interest group? I mean, you know, you find me the parent or grandparent who doesn't care whether or not their kid gets type 2 diabetes before they turn 12. You know, there's no such person. And the links between soda consumption and ill health are so clearly established. So the only defenders of that provision, of using SNAP dollars to buy soda, are people who work for the soda companies. And yes, they're a powerful special interest with deep pockets, but they're nothing compared to a nation of loving parents and grandparents. So, you know, while we're waiting for that special interest group to form and be 250 million strong, we're counting on the Food Revolution to advance the mission.
Well, we're doing what we can. And you know, David, you dedicated your book, Disease Proof, to your patients with gratitude for the rewarding privilege of sharing skills in pursuit of health. I want to thank you for doing just that in your life, in your work with us today, with sharing your enormous knowledge and your commitment to health with us, and on behalf of myself and of Ocean, and really on behalf of everyone involved in the food revolution and everyone working for a healthier world, I thank you. I thank you for your wonderful work, and I thank you for being with us today.
It's very kind, John, and all I can do is reciprocate in kind. I've learned a lot from you, and I've been inspired by your example throughout my career. So I'm very grateful to you and Ocean for the great work that you do.
We've been talking with Dr. David Katz, founding director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center and founder of the True Health Initiative. David, in a world in which nutritional dialogue and medical practice are so often dominated by special interests and commercial and political agendas, yours is a voice of sanity and clarity. We want to thank you for your decades of brilliant leadership and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you very much, Ocean. It's a privilege to join you.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.